special Break and Kidney with Byron and Barry. You know, we like to say, Barry, that we talk not just about pro wrestling, but about pop culture, life, sports, movies, television. Today, for your listening pleasure, Break and Kidney with Byron and Barry goes Hollywood. Barry, are you ready to cross this threshold?
This is going to be such an exciting episode because we have a very special guest, somebody who was delayed last week, passing of her brother. May he rest in peace, and we actually offer our condolences. But we have a historian of not just the punk rock scene of Los Angeles, but really the Los Angeles music scene, and somebody that didn't watch it from a distance, Jeff, somebody who was right thick in the middle of everything. And of course, if you've listened to the show over the last couple of months, I've mentioned her numerous times. Pleasant Gaiman will be joining us later on today. Super fucking excited for this one.
And we will finally get around to talking in depth about the recent Go-Go's documentary that was on Showtime. So I am looking forward to that, Barry. Along with that, we, of course, will feature a match of the week. We are going back to May 21st, 1983 in Houston, not at the Sam Houston Coliseum, Barry. A very rare visit to the Houston Summit for this match. And we got some other stuff to talk about. However, Barry is crushed, heartbroken. There is no food topic this week. I will mention that Adam Dumau, I think, posted something about the top 100 rock bands of all time. And I promised Barry that I was going to research that. Maybe not. So let's talk about a couple things before we get to our match of the week. Barry, huge news out of the Bowdrin household, as you may have read online today. So besides everything else that's happened with me, with the chemo and the cancer, you know, my doctor, when I visited him about a month ago, he says, yeah, you know, you should start returning to normal about 6 to 8 weeks. You know, yeah, you're not going to have any food issues. Your strength's going to start coming back. You'll start putting weight on. Yeah. And so imagine how surprised, not in a good way, I was that, you know, I had maintained, although I shaved my head pretty much back in February in preparation for the chemo, and I didn't want to be one of these people that had chunks of hair falling out. So I did mainly a head shave, but I still have my goatee and my mustache. And as I mentioned to you, I've had my goatee and mustache pretty much since like the mid to late 80s, Bear. And I was very happy because he had told me, yeah, you're going to lose that. And your eyebrows, too, are probably going to go. And, you know, we've all seen pictures of people that have suffered through the ravages of chemo. And so I was very happy that here I was done with my chemo and I still had my eyebrows. I still had my mustache. I still had my goatee. The other night, the lovely Mrs. Bowdrin, love of my life, says to me, hey, you know, the mustache and goatee are getting a little wispy looking there. You kind of lost most of it. Why don't you just go ahead and shave the things off? I'm like, you know, honey, I've had this stuff for over 30 years. It's kind of a big moment in my life if I do this. And she hits me with this one, Barry. Oh, but you'll probably look younger if you shave the mustache and goatee. As I posted online, she actually kept a straight face when she said that. So I kind of said, what the fuck? I went upstairs a couple hours ago, Barry, shaved off what was left of my mustache, what was left of my goatee. And, I haven't been like this since maybe like, my first marriage. We're talking 83, 84 ish. And, it's different for me, you know, I don't know.
So when will we be seeing a photo?
That's what everyone's asking. And I don't want to put any photos up because I think my face looks really fat and it makes me look, like I have,
but you can't. You're like teasing us now with this, Jeff. You can't come out.
Well, I'm nothing if not a tease.
You're a huge tease. There's no way you could tease us with this kind of information and then say, no photos. Fuck you. You're not going to get the photos. Jeff, we are demanding photos. I am personally going to get my vehicle, my RAV4, drive down to Cumming, Georgia, snap a photo, and post it to Facebook. What do you think about that?
Will it be a Costanza-like photo shoot?
You know? Yes. Yes, it will.
So, We'll see, because I'm worried about the double chin, quite frankly, being even more exposed than it was before. So here's another question I have for you. And Lou, feel free to join us, even though we're not talking food. I've started physical therapy about a week or so ago. And after, you know, after all the weight I lost a lot of strength, a lot of muscle tone. So physical therapy at this point, my wife suggested it to me because she's, of course, an occupational therapist. And oh, my God, Barry, it's just been brutal. You ever had an injury you had to recover from and take physical therapy?
No, never.
Sweet Lou?
I had an injury. I didn't, but no physical therapy.
No, not really.
So I'm on my own here, basically. And so, so one of the things that apparently they don't allow in Florida, because I, you know, I'm also getting therapy for my shoulder. I've discussed my, you know, I have a torn labrum in my left shoulder. So one of the things they do not do in Florida, but apparently they do allow in Georgia, is this concept called dry needling. Anybody familiar with this?
No.
Lou?
No, not that particular. No.
Okay. So dry needling apparently is something they do not allow in Florida for whatever reason. And it's a concept they do allow here in Georgia. What they do is you take it's a very small needle. It's sort of like acupuncture. Anybody have acupuncture? Barry, Lou, either of you ever had acupuncture?
No.
Yes, I have.
Okay, there you go. Finally, a yes vote there. So what they do is they put the acupuncture needle in the area of concern, which in my case is my shoulder, and then they hook it up to an electrode, and they give you like electrical stimulation through the acupuncture needles into the area of concern, shall we say. And so at first she started, and she's like, oh, you feel that? I said, no. She goes, well, let me just adjust it a little bit. She goes, because when you adjust it to the right spot, you'll see your like, I don't know if it's the muscle or the skin, will begin twitching involuntarily. So ooh. I'm like, oh, no. Okay, there it is. So you watch your skin and the area underneath begin to twitch involuntarily, which is like a little on the disturbing side, quite frankly. I've only had one treatment. They're going to do it once a week. It's definitely something that is a little different, needless to say. But yeah, physical therapy, Bear, just absolutely brutal so far.
Yeah, and this is Kim does this for a living, correct?
Well, she deals primarily with the hand and wrist. You know, people have carpal tunnel, or if they, you know, break a wrist, or, you know, she's done people that have lost a hand or lost fingers in accidents. She teaches them how to, you know, use it again and stuff like that. So she usually doesn't do shoulders. Certainly not gotcha. Mine. I can tell you that.
So with carpal tunnel syndrome, I've always heard it comes from one of two ways, actually three ways. One is playing tennis. You play tennis, you can get carpal tunnel. The other is, I think if you're on the computer with the mouse, you can also get it. But excessive masturbation is the third. Would that be correct, Jeff?
Well, then you would certainly be a candidate for that based on
what I've
heard. But no, repetitive motion, you know, so to your point, if you're a chronic masturbator, I'm sure you could be a candidate for carpal tunnel. But, you know, like whether you are you're at a keyboard all day, whether you write, you know, like repetitive motion with writing and stuff like that, you know, any of that stuff could cause it. But so anyway, before we get to our match of the week, Barry, couple wrestling related topics I want to address with you. I posted on the board today a picture of Randy Savage and my question. And I said, there's really no right or wrong answer, but I thought it was an interesting topic. And I was kind of amazed by the initial response that we got because I was, you know, I said, Randy Savage, was he better with Elizabeth or with Sensational Sherry? And I was really kind of expecting a landslide for Miss Elizabeth there, because that's who, you know, he was married to her and he's so associated with her. But people forget how great Sensational Sherry was with Randy also. So in your opinion, Barry, who would you say? It was Randy better with Liz or with Sherry?
And Jeff, this was such an excellent question that I immediately got onto Facebook and I responded to it. First off, let me say, I think Randy Savage was so great, he didn't need anybody. I don't think, you know, to me, it's like one of these guys that is a great talker and you give him a manager. And at the end of the day, it wasn't that Sherry was doing the talking. Liz certainly wasn't doing any talking for Randy. But Randy was just one of these guys. I don't think he needed anybody. With that being said, sensational Sherry by a landslide. I was not a fan of Liz. And I remember we discussed this on one of the earliest episodes that I was on, first, second, third episode. And there were a couple people, I think, that were a little outraged. To me, Liz was literally a living, breathing cardboard cutout. She offered, she was beautiful. She was, could have been the greatest person on the face of the earth, but she didn't really offer anything. And I get it. That was part of what the gimmick was. Randy was this control freak and he was trying to suppress her, keep her down. And she wasn't really going to do a whole lot. But to that, we grew up watching great managers in professional wrestling, guys like Sir Oliver Humperdinck and J.J. Dillon. I mean, the list is endless. And you've got Liz, who, let's be honest, didn't really do a damn thing. So, you know, I feel bad because apparently she was such a nice person. But at the same time, I just never fully got it. I never fully understood it because she never did anything. Sensational Sherry, though, she was a fucking workhorse. She was not only a fantastic professional wrestler, she had the psychology of professional wrestling and she understood it. And, you know, again, I don't think Randy really needed somebody, but her time with Randy, she was amazing. She was fantastic. So for me, it's not even a contest. As you said, it's a landslide for me. It was sensational Sherry all the way.
Well, let me just point out that, you know, as far as being cardboard cutout, that's what Liz's character was supposed to be.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, however, as you said, Sherry was absolutely stellar in her role with Randy. And, you know, I remember she's taking bumps left and right. Her character was great. You know, someone pointed out that she basically devoted her life to the wrestling business. And, you know, God bless her for that. But she was, you know, and I remember as I, you know, after I posted it, I was remembering the deal they did where Randy and Sherry came down to the ring. Was the final split between Randy and Sherry. And they showed Liz in the audience. And I don't know if this is a SummerSlam or one of the Saturday night's main event. And something happened and there was some kind of schmoz in the ring and the camera hits Liz in the audience and Liz jumps out of the crowd and goes running over and, you know, gets after Sherry. And I remember at that moment, I was going, wow, this is friggin' amazing stuff, man. This is great television. And then of course, she's sitting there waiting and Randy sees her and realizes that Liz has rescued him from Sherry and he goes over and he hugs her and the pop from the crowd was just amazing. And that was, you know, I said it before, it was great television. And, you know, you don't have enough of those moments, especially in the wrestling business at this moment, you know. So next thing I want to ask you. So this question came up. We were talking about some WCW. I think we had the Steiner Brothers match. I don't know if it was last week or the week before. So, Barry, I'm going to ask you to take an interesting position. For once, not me, you, Barry Rose, are going to be Booker. You're the booker in WCW, say 1990, 1991-esque, okay? As a matter of fact, let's make it 91 because the problems with Flair have started and Flair has taken off, okay? So,
okay.
Who do you make the world champion out of these four guys, okay? Now, understanding that, you know, I understand the push that, you know, one or two of them has received as opposed to the push the other two have, but let's talk creatively about all four guys. So, my four candidates are Lex Luger, Sting, Rick Steiner, or Scott Steiner. So given the choice of those four guys, knowing their strengths and weaknesses, which one of those four guys should make the world champion?
So if I'm looking at this, Jeff, I think the difference between the old school territories and then getting into the 90s and certainly the eras that we're in now, in the old days, especially the territory days, there were a lot of politics involved. Guys who were great professional wrestlers wouldn't be given the belt because, A, maybe they weren't – like Billy Robinson, considered a fantastic wrestler, but not a great draw. People weren't paying a lot of money to go see him. But then there were other guys like Dick Slater, who was considered – apparently considered, but then at the same time was so unpredictable that he couldn't be trusted to have a belt. Guys
he
like
literally
Johnny
was
Valentine.
Mr. Unpredictable.
Literally, you're right. Johnny Valentine, another one, Ray Stevens, and this was a question that that was asked on in our group today. But, you know, in the old days, guys who had the talent weren't given the belt because they couldn't be trusted. I think as you move into the 90s, you have to view things completely different. And I think this whole personal bias or political bullshit, you know, doesn't kiss enough ass, that's all got to go out the window. If a guy can draw, if a guy can sell a merchandise, that's business, that's the guy you should be putting the belt on. You don't have to like him. The point is, if he's making everybody money, that's the guy you got to go with. So the question is, and this is maybe this is where I turn this back on you because I don't know the answer to it. Who was the biggest star of those four? And I'm talking either ratings or merchandise in 1991. With that being said, I don't think it was Rick Steiner because I think he had already jumped the shark by that point. I think that they had already passed on him. Scott Steiner might be there, but I think it's probably going to come down to Luger or Sting, at least in my opinion.
So I think part of the problem that WCW had, they had created Lex Luger, who essentially was Hulk Hogan 2.0. Okay. And one of the big mistakes that they made was no matter how good Lex Luger got, and let's talk Lex Luger. You know, I've mentioned before on this show, late 88 into 1990. Okay. When Lex Luger was at his zenith, his penultimate, if you will, Barry, there's a word we haven't used in a while.
Oh.
And when he was at his zenith, as good as he was in the ring, and he was, of course, also wrestling with guys like Ricky Steamboat and Brian Pillman. He was wrestling with good opponents in Flair. You know, he was still, he still came off as some sort of, I don't want to say second-rate Hulk Hogan, because that's really being dismissive of what he was, you know, able to accomplish during that time frame. But he really came off as Hogan 2.0, okay? And I think if you're going to compete with the WWF at that time, if you as WCW, if I'm the guy sitting there writing the checks and creating everything in WCW, like I was in my fabulous book, They Call Me the Booker, available Crowbar Press, I think you need to have somebody that's the opposite of a Hulk Hogan. You know, you don't want to be seen as, oh, that guy's just like Hulk Hogan. No, you want to have somebody completely different. Now, here is something that I have not revealed. Chris Zaha, get ready because you're going to be shocked. I was never a huge fan of Sting's. For whatever reason, he was a good athlete. You know, he had a lot of charisma, no question about that. But I just think that they kind of, you know, you said that Rick Steiner had kind of jumped the shark. I think the whole thing was Sting had kind of jumped the shark by then, too. You know, they were able, and giving credit when Eric Bischoff, I don't know if he was the one that came up with it, but the whole idea of Sting as the Crow and all that kind of stuff, that definitely rejuvenated the character of Sting and took it in a new direction. I give him credit for that. But to me, the guy, if you say that Rick Steiner had jumped the shark, the guy that they should have given the ball to and at least seen what he could do is Scott Steiner, because I think Scott Steiner is the antithesis. He was a different looking guy than Hulk Hogan. Yeah, he was well muscled, but he was doing stuff that Hulk Hogan could never do. The Frankensteiner, you know, some of the suplexes and stuff like that. And at this point, we hadn't started getting into the unreliable, you know, Scott Steiner. We hadn't started getting into the guy that was sort of taking over the program. And if that happened, of course, you do something and you remove the belt from him. But I think in 1991, Scott Steiner is the guy they should have given the ball to and just see what could have happened. What do you think?
I think from an in-ring talent standpoint, you might be right. I think the flaw in Steiner's game, the interviews were horrific from day one till his last interview. But the other aspect, the unreliability, the loose cannon aspect of Scott Steiner, the beating up of jobbers. And there's a lot of people who love Scott Steiner, but you also looked at professional wrestling. You're giving your body to your opponent, and it's based off of trust. And both the Steiner brothers, but especially Scott, developed reputations for just beating up jobbers and beating up job guys in the ring. And to me, that's just not a guy that I would want to put the title on. With that, if he wasn't doing any of that, and we're looking at just in-ring talent, he had it. I mean, because as you said, he could do everything. He was an incredible looking athlete, but at the same time, he was doing things that other people could just dream of. That's a tough one. Luger, and we've been very, very critical of guys like Luger, and, Kevin Nash, and even Sting to some degree. I don't know what year Sting cooled off. And I think you're right. I think by 91, he might have cooled off a little bit. I want to say it was 88, 89 is when Sting was really on fire when he first came in.
No, there's no question about that. He definitely was.
Yeah. And then certainly, as you pointed out with the Crow gimmick, which, my God, that went on for like a year where he was just up in the stands. But that gave him some sort of rejuvenation. But he was over with the people. And that's a big thing. He could do an interview, seemed like a level headed guy that, given the ball, could have done something. Luger obviously had the look. But yeah, that's a tough one. I think Scott Steiner is probably the right choice, Jeff.
OK, so. Couple more things real quick. Some anniversaries to note today, the day we record this. The birthday of one of my personal favorites, the Nature Boy, Buddy Landell Bear.
Oh, and he was. And that was a guy that I forget at some point. I don't know. We probably don't have the time. We got a hell of a show today. But you have to go through how you initially met Buddy and formed a friendship. When we were doing chair shots, Buddy gave an interview. So Buddy was really good friends with Jimmy Jett, the old referee, Jimmy Jett, Jimmy Berkeley. And Jimmy was a good friend of mine. And Jimmy was broken in the business from Buddy. So they were really, really close. And Buddy was the life of the party, as talented a wrestler as ever stepped into a ring at any point, and his problems are well documented. But he did this interview, and we probably should post it. And he basically came out and he said that he was screwed up his entire life because of childhood trauma. And I think that was the first time that he had ever publicly spoken about it. And he got very emotional about it. And it's just a real shame because, Buddy, obviously, and again, these stories are so well documented. Buddy shot himself in the foot every time he was given a break, with the exception of the time when he was in the WWF and he broke his leg, right? Wasn't it his leg or his ankle that he broke?
I think it was his ankle. That was the one where he was coming out of a hotel and slipped on ice.
Yeah, it was something like that. And it was like the guy finally gets his shit together through no fault of his own, gets his break. He's in the Federation. I remember he had one or two matches on Raw, and he was Buddy. He was great. Buddy couldn't have a bad match if he tried. And of course, he has to break his leg, and that was it. That was pretty much the last we saw of him. Just a tragedy. And it's a shame that he died so young as well,
Yeah. And, but I've mentioned this before, very much like I feel like Sammy Guevara, in the sense that Buddy could lose on television every single week and he lost none of his heat. You still looked at him as a quality main event type of guy. He did some really great interviews. Everybody remembers his interviews before the match with Shawn Michaels, where he basically came clean on his past. Legendary figure in Mid-South. There's all those stories about how he basically would have to turn over his paycheck to Bill Watts for all the fines that Bill had levied against him, either for being late or for missing a show. I was very fortunate enough to meet Buddy and become friendly with him. And he was quite the character. Yeah, and I'll have to tell you, one of the articles I did, I believe it was in Chair Shots. Something had happened with me and Buddy where there was some sort of misunderstanding. And in the course of my article, it wasn't the focal point of my article, but it was sort of like at the very bottom of the article, I put something, and I didn't want to say, hey, this is the Buddy, and let everybody know that I was friends with Buddy. And I said, this is to, and I used his wife's name's husband. I said, and I kind of explained what had happened, and I said, give me a call. Well, apparently the fact that I used his wife's, you know, real name, just, you know, he saw it and got completely even worse. You know, he got even more upset with me and more infuriated with me. And I was like, oh my God, I'm trying to explain myself. And I apparently chose the wrong, you know, used the wrong way of thinking about it. But we were able to resolve our differences before he unfortunately passed away. So today, in honor of his birthday, we raise an adult beverage to the memory of the great Nature Boy. And I post on Twitter, the real Nature Boy. I did that just to kind of stir the pot a little bit. But the Nature Boy, Buddy Landell. Next, I also want to mention, and then we'll get to the match of the week, Barry. Today, I saw a reference, I don't know if it was Facebook or Twitter, would have been the anniversary of Dusty Rhodes and his wife, Michelle. Now, Michelle apparently is the mom of Cody. It was Dusty's first wife that was the mom of Dustin. So in all your CWF background, did you get a chance to meet either one of Dusty's wives?
I did, Jeff, and I actually posted that in the CWF group from the newspaper. So I did. I got to meet his second wife, Michelle Rubio, one time. Very nice, very understated, where Dusty had a larger than life personality. She was kind of the opposite. She was low key. She was quiet. Nothing remarkable in any form. I never met the first wife. I want to say they were either divorced or separated, like by the time that I got into professional wrestling. So I never got to meet her. But nice woman. Nothing I can much say about her.
Okay, so now it is time for our match of the week. As I said, we are going to May 21st, 1983, in the Summit in Houston, Texas. Not in the Sam Houston Coliseum, because this was a Southwest wrestling promotion. So, Barry, what we have here is the Southwest Championship Wrestling. They had got on the USA Network. They decided, I'm sure they were probably having trouble getting bookings for one of the world champions. They decided to have a tournament to create their own world champion. And what we have here is the finals between Adrian Adonis and Bob Orton Jr. First of all, what do you think of those two guys in the final for a world champion? And Lou Thesz presenting his original NWA belt, I believe, to the winner of the match. And tell us what you think about the match, and then we'll talk about it some more.
Yeah, so on paper, Bob Orton Jr. and Adrian Adonis, I think, would be great in the finals of a world heavyweight title match. Orton Jr. was just fantastic at this stage, too. And really, throughout most of his career, we saw him in Florida in 76, and I think he was one of the best in the country at that point. He was just a phenomenal worker, and he continued all throughout his career. Adonis, at this stage, I think, was entering into some of the best work of his career. You know, he had bounced around. He was Keith Frankie for years. I don't know how long he had been Adonis. I guess probably since the late 70s. I think he started in Amarillo, where he flipped over to Adonis. And he was doing that $1,000 silver dollar challenge where marks would come in the ring and they would wrestle Adonis, and if they could beat him, they'd get, $1,000. And just consider how dangerous that must have been, but it's also a testament to how tough Adonis must have been in real life. As a match, though, Jeff, this match, I don't think I've ever said it on the show, this match sucked. And at first it hurts for me to say that, because you have two guys that are, I think, two of the most talented professional wrestlers ever. But at the same time, this match is an absolute snooze fest. And the reality of it is, and this is my assumption, because Lou Thesz, I feel Lou Thesz is responsible, because
it's all Lou's fault.
It's all Lou's fault.
Not Kippelman.
This is a wrestling match between these two, and it's almost like two baby – these are two heels. They're wrestling an all-babyface wrestling match, And it is the complete opposite. Absolutely.
Let me just say, you know what this reminded me of? This reminded me stylistically of the kind of match you'd see in the early 70s. Am I wrong there? Because there was almost no high spots in this match. It was all mat wrestling, some chain spots and stuff. But you're absolutely right. Barry, you're 100% right. There was no underhanded, shots to the throat. Nobody pulled any hair. This something that you would expect from the two guys at this point in their career.
Yeah, and like I say, I have a feeling that Lou Thesz. So we should say too, Lou Thesz being there, he's got the belt. The belt is referred to as the original NWA World's title. He's had it for 75 years. He gives a speech on the microphone. It's a really nice touch by having him there, but I get the feeling that Lou was such a stickler on so many levels that he didn't want some sort of bloodbath between these two or some sort of, he wanted a straight wrestling match for the wrestling title, and that's what he got. To the audience, it's a snooze fest because literally there's not one high. There's an attempted high spot where Orton's going for the superplex off the top rope. That doesn't happen. And that's about it. There's a couple of punches. The finish is as anticlimactic. It's essentially a cradle, and then Adonis reverses it and he gets the three count. What really hurts this match also, Jeff, is the fact that there's no commentary. And a good commentator could have made this at least halfway exciting. And the fact that we're watching the match with no commentary whatsoever, there's nothing there. And to me, it's a shame because, again, these are two of the best wrestlers and they should have had an outstanding match. One should have clearly been defined as the heel. The other, a clear definition of a babyface, and we didn't get either. I am under the assumption to some degree that Adonis was the heel and maybe Orton Jr. was supposed to be the babyface. But it certainly didn't seem like that was happening. A couple of things. It's a slow match. I wrote slow start. Well, the whole match is slow, so no commentary hurts it. Adonis bloody at one point, Jeff, or is that?
Well, I think what happened was he came into the ring. Apparently, in the semifinal match, he had probably cut himself, and he was wearing the bandage. And at some point, the cut reopened it.
Yeah, because when you see, there's no spot that would cause him to be bleeding at all. I do wonder where this belt is. It was 75 years old, 35 years ago. Isn't that right? So somewhere around 110 years right now, this belt would be in age. Love to know where that is. Is Adonis a good choice as your first world champion? I don't know. And again, I'm an Adonis fan. That's not a knock on him, but is that the guy that I would make my first world champion, especially bringing him into Texas where he has, in that area, he had zero history in Houston. He doesn't have history in Houston or San Antonio. So am I going to bring him in? I don't know. Calling it a world title, was there anybody in that building that thought that this was going to be a world title, defended anywhere outside of Texas? I don't see that. I think the highlight for me is the audio picking up conversations at ringside. There's a lot of I'm assuming the timekeeper saying, yeah, we'll meet you in the back. We'll get some photos back there later. There's this idle chitter chat going on between people at ringside, which I'm a ring announcer, and the microphone's picking it all up. That I really enjoyed. Here's a funny thing. There are a couple photographers at ringside. One looks like Raul Gomez de Molina Jr. Are you familiar with that name, Jeff?
Yes, of course. He worked the CWF rings for many years.
Yes, and he was Miami Beach had a ton of photographers. You had Brian Berkowitz, Ruth Oman, Raul Gomez de Molina Jr., Paul Bauman, Don DeLeon, Howard Baum, Pete Lederberg, and probably, I think I just named seven, but there were others as well. Raul was a guy, he shot strictly for the Japanese wrestling magazines, and they would send him all over the state, and his work was fantastic. But if you were seeing photos in any of those Japanese wrestling magazines, that's generally Raul's work, and we knew Raul fairly well. The funny thing was, Raul was a guy that if you were going to tell me out of everybody that was a regular at Miami Beach at the professional wrestling matches, that one day somebody would have their own TV show, I would have Raul at the very bottom of the list. Of course, Raul does have his own TV show. He's had it for, I think, 20 years. It's on either Univision or Galavision. It's called Gordo y Flaca. And Raul being the Gordo of the and Flaca being this very attractive blonde and blonde brunette. I forget what color hair. She's really hot, though. But Raul's got his own TV show, and he's had it for like 20 years, and apparently it's very successful. A hell of a photographer, and it does look like him. And I wonder, did the Japanese magazine send him out to Houston because of Lou Thesz as well? Because Lou Thesz obviously being a god and an icon in Japan. So really interesting to see him there. But overall, again, this match, Jeff, I remember watching it, and I don't remember being as grossly disappointed as I was today when I watched it. But I got to tell you, holy shit, it's a 20-minute snooze fest.
Well, here's the thing. One of the things I don't understand. Okay, you correctly stated that both guys, terrific workers. But let's be honest, Adonis was primarily known, at least on a national level at that point, as being part of the tag team with Jesse Ventura. He did not have a national reputation. Okay. I don't even think leading up to this tournament, I don't even think he may have worked for Southwest. Do you remember? Did he work there?
I don't think so. No. Yeah. I think they brought him in. Yeah.
And I'm not even sure Bob Orton Jr. did either, but I will say that Bob Orton Jr. had more of a reputation as a singles guy than a tag team, even though he was a great tag team wrestler. He also had the reputation of being a great singles guy too. So I think if they were going to put the strap on anybody, it should have been Bob Orton Jr. Okay. Who had a little bit more of a national reputation, had been in a bunch of different territories. But since it was Southwest, I'm really kind of confused as to why. I mean, I understand why they didn't put it on like somebody like Tully Blanchard or Bob Sweetan. But, you know, they had also used guys like, you know, Wahoo, Dick Slater, people like that, even Manny Fernandez. I'm surprised they didn't put it on one of their own guys. I mean, are you surprised at all by that?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It doesn't make any sense. Why wouldn't you – your first champion, I'm not talking down the road, whatever, but your first champion, to me, should be Terry Funk, if Terry Funk's willing. Sure. You know? Exactly. Why any Dory Funk, Manny Fernandez, the list goes on. Anybody who's already connected with the audiences, the crowds in Texas, the belt should have gone on. And then you could have had Adonis come in a month later and win the title. You know, New York or Yankee comes into town and steals the title. Perfect, right?
Sure. And you know, and then also you get of them a month's worth of buildup as a single, just have him go in there and destroy people so that he gets a little more appreciated by the audience that you're trying to reach, not just on a local level, where, because let's be honest, they weren't running any shows outside of Texas. And that's another thing, you know, this whole idea that we've got to run in a big arena to make it look like we're a big deal. You know, there was, you mean to tell me there was no building in San Antonio? I know they ran TV at the Junction, I think, but the Spurs were already in the NBA. They could have just run the damn thing in the basketball arena in San Antonio. But a lot about this tournament that I did not understand back in 1983, and I certainly don't understand it now. But I did not hate the match as much as you did, Barry. I see the points that you brought up. They're certainly valid ones. I want to say this was an average match, 2.5 stars kind of thing. Nothing special, but I didn't consider it the dud perhaps that you thought. Maybe I'm just an easy grader. I don't know.
No, I don't think you are. It's you know what? I think a lot of it, again, is the disappointment of knowing who the two guys are and expecting that, you know, I sit down and like, OK, you got, again, I think two of the best wrestlers. Adonis, criminally underrated. Orton Jr., his career speaks for himself with that. And then you sit down and you're watching this. And you know what? Your analogy of an early 1970s, match. And here's another thing. This match. The match that you referred to from the 1970s wouldn't have even been the main event. Like that would have been a match either mid-card or in the prelims. This there's no way in any form this match screams main event based off of the way these two worked with each other. And I never saw Bruno versus Pedro from Shea Stadium, but a lot of people who saw that match, all they tell you, man, it was supposed to be a terrible match.
Yes, I've heard that also. You know, and here's another thing. The whole idea of the one night tournament never works.
Right.
You know, I went out to, as a matter of fact, out to Houston, Texas to watch the Western States Heritage tournament that I think Barry Windham won. And it just, the sum of its part did not equal, you know, what the end result was. And I think if you're going to do a tournament, you know, I know Bill Watts used to do this. They would really put the time and effort into it where they would have the brackets. Okay, this week you're going to see this match, and the winner of this match is going to meet the winner of the match that's going to come next week. And, you know, they would really map it out for you. But just to do it, first of all, none of the matches end up going like, you know, over a certain amount of time until you get to the main event. And I'm sure by you know, after wrestling two or three matches already, you know, like you said, this match was under 20 minutes. I'm sure both guys had, you know, put a lot of effort into the first two or three matches they worked that night. So, you know, it's just, you know, you can never rely on a U.S. promoter over the years to put together a good one night tournament, Barry.
Yeah, and that, so you're taking, look, obviously hindsight, we already know the deal, but you're taking something that you're trying to prop up as a world title. Why don't we just do a one night tournament to decide the champion?
And a town, right? We don't run in.
Exactly. Genius. So how could this promotion fail on any level, Jeff? Yeah. How could that happen?
Same with promotion decisions decided like it would be a good idea for someone to dump a bucket of shit on top of somebody, you know,
exactly.
on a national cable network. Well, what could go wrong there? So
what could go wrong there?
Anyway, Barry, I know we have reached a point in the show that has got you excited, maybe a little even chubby, now, Barry, it is time for us to go and visit with Pleasant Gaiman. We're going Hollywood. Barry, you ready to go Hollywood?
You know what? I am going to change my nickname from Lawn Shitter to Hollywood. So, yeah, I'm ready to go.
Hollywood Rose. That's you.
Hollywood Rose.
Let's talk a little L.A. punk. Let's talk a little Go-Go's. Let's talk a little celebrity gossip. Let's go to our interview with Pleasant Gaiman.
So, Jeff, this is a big moment. We were delayed in speaking with Pleasant a couple of weeks back, the unfortunate passing of her brother. But we are thrilled that she is joining us today. So a little background. And, you know, as I go through Pleasant's biography, she is an actress, she is an author, she is a singer, she is a belly dancer, she is a tarot card reader, she is a witch. I believe she's covering all the bases, Jeff. Pleasant Gaiman, thank you so much for joining. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good, but it's hot as hell here in LA. Insane. So I'm melting like any witch would.
So, you know, we've brought you up a few times on our podcast, and a lot of it has to do with you really were at the forefront of the Los Angeles punk rock scene. And the truth is, you know, at this stage, being that, you know, we're looking at, I guess, you know, depending on when it started, was it 1975? Was it 1977 that it came to the forefront? But we're looking somewhere at roughly 45, 43 years. There's not a lot of people that were there that are still with us, but there's not a lot of people that were there that collectively still have all of their brain cells. And you have, which is true.
Have mine. Don't ask me. I don't remember how I kept them. No.
Well, you did, though, because I've read your books. I've read your chapters in both of John Doe's books, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and they're fantastic. But your memory is incredible. And if it wasn't for people like you being able to document and to preserve this history, a lot of this stuff would be lost forever. So the first question, and I know that you showed up to LA when you were 16 years old. Where did you come from? Because for some reason, I thought you were born and bred in Los Angeles.
No, I was born in New York City, and I lived in upstate New York in in the days when our phone numbers were party lines and only had 4 digits. Then I moved to Connecticut, also a small town, but it was, my mother was teaching at Wesleyan University, and it was the 60s. And, you know, I relate this directly to punk rock. So I'm just going to say that growing up on a college campus in the 60s was so fucking insane. Wait, we're allowed to swear on this, right?
Oh, we actually encourage it. We encourage it.
Okay. I should have checked before. It just fell out of my mouth. Yeah. So like my first rock and roll concert, not one that I necessarily chose to go into, was the Grateful Dead with the Merry Pranksters there on the further bus in the middle of a football field. And my babysitters got me drunk and got me wasted on weed. And we went there, and everybody was, you know, there was like hundreds of people there dressed like all crazy hippies. And there was someone doing a headstand with their legs in the lotus position on top of the bus. And there was a ring around the rosy going on, like around the whole football field, which was probably at least 300 or 400 people strong. And it was the best thing I had ever seen. And that kind of like that and the Beatles on Ed Sullivan sort of like shaped my, you know, which I saw as it happened when I was like 4, I think.
So how old were you when you went to the Grateful Dead concert, though, if you don't mind me asking?
9.
Okay. Wow.
But so, yeah, those two incidents were like very early rock and rolly memories for me. And then I was like, you know, from the age of 9 onwards, I was absolutely wild, feral child, which actually, like, you know, in those days, kids weren't kept on like the type of leashes they are today. So whenever I tell like younger people about what my childhood was like growing up, like they don't believe it. And I'm not even talking about concerts or drugs. I mean, just shit. Like you could play hide and seek and it could be over like a square mile radius, and you could just run into strangers' houses and like hide in their attics. sometimes you would tell them, and other times you would just slip in through an open door or a window. My brother and I used to play in a cemetery that was close to our house. We were always around the dorms, you know, going the dorms at the university. And we used to play pigs and pushers instead of cops and robbers, because, you know, that was like the 60s terms. And we were the ones that started. Yeah. We started calling it that. And none of us ever wanted to be like, you know, the police. Like we always made this kid that was like the son of the minister. He was the only one that ever wanted to be the police. So the rest of us, I'd be like, I'm Bernadine Dorn from the Weathered Underground and stuff like that.
Wow.
We just, yeah. And you know, we did all sorts of psychotic other things. Like my brother bought a car with his paper route money when he was 11. And he was too short to like see over the dash. And his feet didn't touch the pedals, but he kept a stack of Playboys in it stolen from the frat houses. And he would drive the car. He drove on the first time he drove it, my mother busted him like sort of across town as she was on her way home from work. But then we made we wanted to sell the Playboys on the playground. And that, then I nixed that idea because it was, you know, they were too big. They wouldn't fit in our lunch boxes, and I was afraid we'd get caught. So then I made my first fanzine, which it wasn't, you know, it wasn't being called that then, but it was called True Smut is what we named it. And I wrote all the stories. We made 10 issues, and I had wrote the stories, and it was my brother's job to cut out the pictures of like the naked girls in it. But obviously, because we only had one copy of each of the source material, the pictures were different in every issue, but as soon as we brought them onto the playground, we sold them for a quarter each, which was astronomical in those days. And by lunchtime, we were busted. Some idiot let it fall out of his book in class.
Where were you guys during my childhood? Literally, I was.
I would have picked up a copy of True Smut. I can tell you that.
Absolutely. For a quarter, Jeff? My God. I would have bought into the company at that stage.
Barry would have happily cut out the photos for you, I can tell you.
Absolutely. Pleasant. I am going to go to the post office tomorrow. I am going to mail you some photos. Absolutely. So you just mentioned weed, and you know, there's this great story, and I actually was relaying this to Jeff and Lou off air earlier. Really, one of your first experiences when you arrived in Los Angeles, you were 16 years old, you smoked a joint with Hollywood royalty. Now, Jeff, I'm going to break kayfabe on this. I have smoked weed with two celebrities. One celebrity was a soap opera actor who you've never heard of, and his girlfriend was working with me at a restaurant in New York. But the other one was Johnny Galecki. And this was not the multi-billionaire Johnny Galecki. This was the guy who was unemployed in between Roseanne and The Big Bang Theory. And
brush with greatness. Is that what you're going with, Barry?
Well, I'm saying that I'm telling you that I smoked weed with Johnny Galecki, but Pleasant is about to completely destroy that and tell you who she smoked a joint with when she was 16 years old, just arriving in Los Angeles.
Please share with us, Pleasant.
Okay, so I had been here for a few days, and Queen was playing. This was actually in 1975. Queen was playing at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. And so I took the bus down Wilshire to go there, you know, still feral childhood days when you could do that as a 16-year-old girl in a messed up like 1940s dress and, you know, crazy, crazy getup. And I found my seat and I was there alone. And this really like good looking older gentleman, he looked really suave, and he just turned around and like handed me a joint, and I took a puff of it. And then all of a sudden I realized it was Tony Curtis.
I'm guessing Tony Curtis would have access to really good weed.
Oh yeah, he did. But I actually have a sicker celebrity story that hasn't been in a book. But so I actually used to snort coke with Luke Skywalker because he was friends with this band called The Quick, who were Kim Fowley's like boy band. He didn't put them together, but he was producing them at the same time he was producing The Runaways, you know. And I was friends with The Runaways, and I knew Kim. And this band, The Quick, was amazing. Like, two of the band members later went on to compose the theme from Friends, since we're talking about TV sitcoms. So Luke Skywalker, I'm just calling him by that name. You know?
No, is this the actor who played Luke Skywalker? Because he's a rapper. Oh, it is Mark Hamill.
No, Mark Hamill. Yeah.
Wow.
No, this was in the 70s. So we used to snort coke, as did everybody back then in those days, backstage at the Starwood, which was a really great club that hasn't been around in decades. But yeah, so that was, I mean, that by that time though, you know, that was like 76, you know, like I was sort of used to doing various substances with people that were kind of famous.
Sure. Jeff, have you ever done any illegal substance with it? Like, you've drank with celebrities that I'm aware of. But yeah, my guess is Jeff's not going to commit to any sort of illegal activity on air, unlike me.
Well, I'm not committing to it because I think the statute of limitations is up there.
That's true.
Like at this point, you can just call it. You can just say, oh, she's old. She's just having dementia.
That'll be our legal defense there. No question about it.
Yeah, exactly. And We're making that phone call right now to get. So you've arrived in LA. This is 75. You're literally right there at the forefront of the punk rock movement. So the first question I would ask you about that, was it 75? Was it 77? 77 seemed like the explosion was taking place of punk rock, though you can trace the roots back, obviously, to a couple years earlier. Where would you pinpoint it at?
Well, I always call like 75 and 76 like the glitter gray area, because there was a lot of glam rock still going on in LA at that time, even though Rodney's English Disco had closed. you know, there was still like glam rock bands around playing, and anyone that there was a huge divide, like probably around early 76 when some people, in the club scene. And when I say that, I mean, all ages clubs like the Whiskey and the Roxy, or there was a bunch of gay juice bars that we used to go to all the time because, you know, we weren't old enough to get into just places that didn't sell food or, you know, that also that only sold liquor, you know? So a lot of people went with the disco and a lot of people went with the more undergroundy rock and roll stuff, which really ran the gamut, as I was saying, from like sort of glam rock, but it wasn't recycled entire glam rock. It was fun, you know, but there was also all these other, other bands that, that were sort of, undergroundy bands, you know, they'd been influenced by, you know, like Jimi Hendrix or, the Stooges or Blue Cheer or just, you know, and old blues, you know, there was a lot of that kind of weird bands. And then also that was sort of the start of Van Halen and the Motels, who were sort of unclassified, like no one was really calling metal metal. And, you know, so there was a lot of good bands and there wasn't any labels on what was going on. So that was kind of 75 and 76. And then punk, by the end of 76, all the people that were initially in the LA punk scene, the ones that were here at that point, we were all hanging out at Licorice Pizza, a record store that used to be, it was a chain. And one of them used to be across the street from the Whiskey because they would always have English imports and they'd have all the imports of the English magazines, even though they came like 3 weeks to a month late because they came over on fucking boats, not like, you know, through air freight, but we would see like a postage stamp sized picture of like Johnny Rotten or, you know, get like Generation X's first single or look at like Susie from the Banshees before she was in Susie and the Banshees, but just when she was like in the Bromley contingent, like the people that used to follow the Sex Pistols around, we'd see these tiny little pictures of them and think it was like the best thing on earth. And it was very close to like what we were starting to look like and do in LA, obviously not with safety pins, but everyone was looking like really outre. And also there was a lot of people at that point, and this is sort of an unheralded thing, that were all the people in the early punk scene, like what it turned into. We met each other by the way we looked, by our taste in music, and also by our taste in movies and books, which is kind of a thing that I think is sort of lost now because everyone gets masked. You know, you get to see a movie en masse, either released in theaters or online, like on Netflix or on any of the other, you know, services, HBO or whatever. But in those days, if you'd seen like an obscure, quote, art house midnight movie, and I'm not talking about only the Rocky Horror Show, but that one was very important. Like if you'd seen like some weird 1940s noir film or some, you know, like crazy other, you know, foreign film or something, we'd know that. We would have read all the books, and by all the books, I mean just like books on odd or obscure subjects, like Black Sun by Harry Crosby, which is pretty sure why John Doe called under the Big Black Sun. Like I'm sure that's why everyone was reading Harry Crosby, which those books had been actually written in the 20s, I believe, and had just been reissued, you know, but like mainstream people weren't reading stuff like that. And then in those days, if you were wearing all black clothing in the 70s, that was considered enough to stop. Like people would like stop in the middle of their driving, you know, and admittedly the traffic in LA was nowhere near what it is now, but like they would stare at you like now it's a uniform. But in those days, that alone was shocking because no one wore black in the 70s, you know. It was, you know, everything was all pastel and patterns and stuff, that for women's clothes and for a lot of men's clothes, it was always either like plaid or paisley or, you know, like if you look at anything from television shows back then, you can see what the color palette was like. You couldn't even find black underwear. Like all the punk girls or glitter girls, in order to look like True Detective sluts, which was our fashion MO, you know, like old.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, just the opposite.
No, that's still part of my Saxon MO, like almost 50 years later. So we would go to the Salvation Army and get like garter belts and bullet bras that were like a dime, you know? Like, I mean, now they'd be like $100, like vintage condition on Etsy or something. no one wanted that shit, but we were like so into it. So there was that little gray area. And then 77 was when it really exploded in LA. And probably the first two punk concerts were right in tandem with each other. And one was this show that the Nerves put on, you know, the band with like Peter Case's band, the Nerves. They rented this little tiny theater called the Orpheum. It was like a 99-seat black box theater that was just off Sunset in this little alleyway called Nellis Street, which was seriously like a block and a half long and like kind of unpaved. You know, this is like right across the street from the Whiskey, basically, except Nellis was like an alley. And so also for the next 2 days, but not on the night of the Nerves thing, the Damned were the first English punks to put out a full-length album, and they were also the first to tour in America. So they were coming to the Starwood, that club I just mentioned before, which was a pretty gigantic club, also owned by Eddie Nash, like, you know, of all the infamy of, you know, there's been several, like, movies about that, you know, all the porn and the Laurel, the unsolved, quote-unquote, Laurel Canyon murders and all of that. Anyway.
Oh, wow.
So anyhow, the Damned were making an in-store appearance at the Starwood, at Bomp Records, which was in the Valley. This was a tiny little hole-in-the-wall record store run by Greg Shaw, who later had the label Bomp Records. And everybody knew that the Damned were going to be there. And so every person that was into, like, punk, or at least English punk, and then, you know, the concept of punk, because there hadn't really been any specific punk gigs yet in L.A. Everybody went to it en masse, coming from all parts of L.A., from the beach cities, from, you know, Central California, blah, blah. And Bomp was like the size of a closet. And so we all were there at 3 p.m, and everyone was like day drinking. This band, The Weirdos, was there, who had been newly formed, and they looked just amazing. They used to look like psychedelic, like what I imagine those garbage dumps in the middle of the Pacific with all the plastic bottles and cans and toys, like that. But as though that's what they looked like. They had all sorts of weird Japanese toys and like peace signs and 60s things and, like, you know, caution tape all tied around their outfits, and they had sticking up straight punk rock hair. They just looked amazing. So we were talking to them, and they told us about this gig that night on April 15th at the Orpheum Theater, which is the one that Peter Case had organized. So then I said, who else was playing besides them? And he said, The Nerves and this new band from San Diego called The Zeros, who were the Zeros of, you know, the single Don't Push Me Around and a few other records. And then later on, Robert Lopez went on to become Elvez. But they were like little kid teenagers. Like, we're talking like junior high, first year in high school teenagers. So they were playing. And so I said, well, the Germs are a band. And this was like, you know, two guys that I had actually met at the Tony Curtis Queen thing. And their names originally, their legal names were George Ruthenberg and Paul Beam. But then they were changed to Pat Smear and Bobby Pinn, who later changed his name to Darby Crash. So I said, well, they just formed a band, and they hadn't even like really practiced yet. Maybe they'd had one or two practices. And this was when they had the drummer, Donna Rhea, who replaced Belinda Carlisle, who had never played drums before, but just, you know, her name was Dottie Danger at that point, and she was going to be their drummer, but didn't. But so her best friend was Lorna Doom. She was in the band. Anyhow, so I got them on the bill by talking to the Weirdos at Bomp Records. And then we all went to my house a bunch of us in their manager, Chris Ashford's car, because he was like a little bit older than us and was one of the only people that had a car. And we started drinking all this cold dock, and then we got all these like licorice whips to tie up Bobby Pin / Darby Crash at. And just we drove on up there. And by the time we got to the stage, by the time they started getting their really crappy equipment on stage, we were all so high on Quaaludes and cold dock, and they couldn't really play anyway. But in a sort of homage to Iggy, like, you know, there was peanut butter and some other kinds of food involved, and it got all over the audience, and they just sounded like a big noise and finally got unplugged. But the Screamers were there with the Damned in tow, and I just remember seeing that they were sitting on top of like the theater chairs, like on the top of the backs of the chairs, and I was like, wow, this is really an event, isn't it? Even though like the Germs had to get dragged off stage. Then the Weirdos were amazing, the Zeros were amazing, and of course the Nerves were always amazing. But that whole little 2-day thing culminated the next two nights when the Damned were playing at the Starwood. And none of us had ever seen anything like that. It was so powerful and so amazing. And just like we'd already had the record, and this was like the first time that a lot of people had a record from, you know, someone from overseas and then gotten to see it. And everyone knew it was the first punk band from Britain to be in LA. So that was like a giant milestone. And at that point, everything just broke open wide for everybody, you know, like, that like got the start off. And then the Mask opened later that year. The Mask was like the first underground punk club in LA, run by Brendan Mullen, RIP. It was in a basement underneath the porn theater called the Pussycat Theater on Hollywood Boulevard, which is now RuPaul's World of Wonder headquarters. The Mask started, and then there were shows there all summer, and you know, there was crazy house parties, like X played in a living room in the middle of like sort of the Hancock Park section of LA, which is known for old movie lands, 1920s mansions, but some of them were in hideous disrepair, as was the one that they were playing in, you know. So that's how LA punk started. And at first there was only probably about 100 people involved in the scene. And it wasn't what people would imagine the scene to be. It was the very beginning of punk rock was super, super inclusive to women and to people of all ethnicities and all ages. There was people there from like, you know, the Haight-Ashbury scene in the 60s, from the Warhol scene in the East Village in the 70s. There was, 12-year-olds and like people that were 60. I mean, it was crazy. You know, there was people that had been in the Beat Generation that were coming to punk shows. It was, and everyone was doing like a bunch of really creative and really arty things. And it wasn't until probably around 1980 that it turned into the hardcore, very masculine driven scene that a lot of people think it was, but it really was not always that way. I know I just went on a really long tirade, but yeah.
I like that kind of stuff too. So, and you just in that all the information you just gave us, literally I had like 50 follow-up questions, and you gave us so much. Yeah, exactly. It's like where to go. So I'm going to pinpoint, and then I definitely want to get on to Disgraceland in a couple of minutes and talk about the Go-Go's and the documentary and your history. But you did bring up Darby Crash, and I got to tell you, I know that Darby was somebody who you were romantically involved with. You've written about that, but he was, to an old punker like myself, Darby was it. Darby was at the very top of the heap. Looking back now, and I believe he's been gone since 1980, if I'm correct, so 40 years.
Yeah, you're correct, yeah.
Had Darby lived, and I realize it's all speculation, had he lived and not died, what would have happened to Darby and the Germs? And I don't know if the Germs would have been together, but I think Darby, in my opinion, Darby would have been a big star to some degree.
Yeah, I think without heroin, being involved. He definitely would have. Let me clarify a couple of points here, though. So I met them that same night I met Tony Curtis, and it was kind of a love triangle with Pat Smear and Darby and me. But Pat, I was his first real legit girlfriend. So we were seeing each other for a while and we broke up. And then, you know, I was kind of like, I mean, I wouldn't say I was, I think nowadays you'd call it friends with benefits with Darby. all of us, like, you know, like really loved each other all the time. We were constantly on the phone, on landlines, you know, doing stuff all the time. The Germs was super influential. And I think, like, after, if there were, I mean, it's hard to speculate on what would have happened if it weren't for that whole first wave of heroin addiction, because then there was another one, like, you know, a few years later in the 80s. There was a lot of heroin floating around LA during that time period. It was really cheap. It was Mexican tar, and it would come up from there. But yeah, he was so charismatic on stage, Darby, and he was such an incredible, like, lyric writer. I mean, and he was also really, really interested in crazy and obscure things that I think a lot of people that love the Germs, I mean, I'm sure there's Germs nerds that, you know a lot about him, but he was really interested in a lot of, and a lot of poetry and a lot of writing and a lot of stuff about cults. We were all completely, when I say all, I mean, Darby, Pat, and I were obsessed with the Manson family, as were a lot of people in LA at that time, because it was like less than 10 years previous, but we were kids. We were little kids because we were teenagers during the punk scene, you know? So, I mean, we were just fascinated at the way any of that stuff worked, you know, and you know, Jonestown and all that other stuff was sort of happening sort of concurrent with a lot of punk stuff, like just with mind control, with Scientology, with occult things. I mean, because there was no social media, which thank God, otherwise we'd all still be incarcerated, I'm relatively sure.
Thank God. Yes.
Yeah. But like, yeah, we made it out without going to jail. Because there was no social media, we would we'd read a lot, and you know, you had to get your hands on an actual book to do research, you know, but also there was people in the punk scene that had known those people, or, you know, had known like people that were in the Beats in the 50s, you know, like Jack Kerouac. I mean, it was crazy. So we were all interested tangentially in so many things. And Darby kind of like made an amalgam of that into not just what his stage persona was, but involved everything from like, you know, a cult leader to like the back room of Max's Kansas City to Iggy in Detroit to anything you could imagine, you know. It was an original, great, crazy, weird thing. And he was so smart. I don't think people realize that either. I know that some people do, but he was literally a genius, you know? Wow. Also on a funny side note, one time I had to interview Nirvana in, this was like in 1992 when they were just blowing up. And so like, Ben sent me up to Seattle to interview them. And this was right after Pat had joined the band. And so we sat in their practice space, which at that point was, you know, just a shitty, worn out sort of industrial warehouse. It wasn't like a slick record company thing by any means. And we're all sitting there, and I've got like my little, you know, Radio Shack cassette recorder down, not even like a micro one, like, you know, like an old school kind of one that you'd have in the 90s. And everyone was monosyllabic, and there was like huge long pauses between the questions I was answering. And I was thinking in my head, how can I say that I'm not like, quote, quote, a journalist? Like, you know, how can I? And then right then, like, just Pat got like the psychic message from me, and he's like, you guys, you know, Pleasant took my virginity. And everyone was like, oh, okay. that kind of changed the energy in the room pretty fast, you know.
Oh yeah. So
anyway, yeah. So
for years, Pleasant, and I think it was a decade, you lived in a house in Hollywood that I lived in Los Angeles. I lived in Hollywood in the mid 80s, and I know exactly where this was, and I must have walked by 1,000 times, and I didn't realize, A, the history of the building now and what was taking place behind closed doors. But for a decade, you lived in Disgraceland, and Disgraceland was a house in Hollywood right near Fredericks of Hollywood. It was owned by Mariska Hargitay's father, who was the ex-husband of Jane Mansfield, Mickey Hargitay, for years. And this became, you know, I've read a million books. I've read both of John Doe's books. I've read your works. The importance of this building and the people who lived here who crashed is probably the best way. They didn't actually live there. They crashed.
No, a lot of people did live there, but everybody crashed there. Yeah.
Right. Red Hot Chili Peppers, Fishbone, TSOL, Reverend Horton Heat, Billy Idol, Stiv Bators of the Dead Boys, Guns N' Roses. It goes on and on. But somebody who's been in the news because of a documentary, and somebody that you've known extremely well, Belinda Carlisle, also lived in this building. And I got to say to everybody listening, I know that Jeff and I have talked about the documentary, and we definitely want to get into it because, Pleasant, you've got a cameo in this documentary, the Go-Go's documentary, which is currently airing on Showtime. I think it's fantastic. I obviously would have loved a little bit more of the punk and a little less of the pop. That being said, they still gave us a shit ton of the punk stuff, and I really love that. So what was it, first off, what was it like in retrospect living in Disgraceland, but what was it like being with Belinda Carlisle as the Go-Go's were starting to explode?
Well, first I'm going to say happy birthday, Belinda, because today's her birthday.
Well, happy birthday, Belinda.
Happy birthday, babe. I know you're not listening to it because you're in Thailand.
Oh, no. I can't believe she is not a subscriber.
Yes. She's a faithful listener every week. Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, she subscribes to every podcast that mentions it. No. So, in the time that Belinda was living in Disgraceland, when she first started living there was 1980, and the Go-Go's were just very much only an LA thing, and they'd gotten good. Like Kathy joined, like as she was at Disgraceland, as Belinda was living at Disgraceland. You know what I mean? That's when like those major shifts were occurring, you know, with the personnel and stuff. Like that was Gina a little bit before, and then Kathy while we were at Disgraceland. And then they were just barely starting to open for more established LA bands, like at that point, like X or the Dickies, or, you know, like the people that wound up getting signed or having albums out early on. So the Go-Go's were just beginning to open for them. And then they went to England, you know, as you know, if you see the documentary or you know the whole Go-Go's history. And they had the single on Stiff Records, but also when they came, you know, while she was living there, they signed to IRS and then started touring with the Police and, you know, doing gigs. And their single, Our Lips Are Sealed, went to number one while she was living at Disgraceland. So one of the stories that I tell in John Doe's book, and I've said it in a couple of other things, because this is just so absurd. I'll repeat it again in case anybody hasn't heard it. Disgraceland was really like, it was in what was and what still kind of is a street that was sort of slummy in Hollywood. And in those days, especially, the only people that were living in that neighborhood were either people that came out to be stars at some point between like the 20s and the early 60s, you know, people in like little studio apartments that like didn't make it in the movie biz, or like families from South America, or lunatic punks living communally, like the way Disgraceland was. I mean, that it was just sort of a downtrodden neighborhood. And now I'm sure that the real estate is worth a lot there, but, you know, still there hasn't been that much gentrification. There has been on the boulevard, but not like in the houses around it. So our house was insane, you know, and it was a slum, like I was saying. And there was this family that lived above us, and they had a teenage daughter that would just, she would play records over and over on repeat, which is, you know, what I always did with the record player. You just move the needle and let it repeat. So either the album or the 45 would repeat. But this little girl bought only singles of top 40. So we'd have to endure listening to like Donna Summer or the Carpenters or whoever the fuck was like on the top 40 then. And it was horrifying. It was like that was like CIA mind control level of horror, you know? So we would counteract it by blasting like the Cramps and, you know, through guitar amps and sticking them in the window to make sure it really made a lot of noise and stuff. But one day it switched from Donna Summer to Our Lips Are Sealed. And at around hour five, Belinda seriously started losing it because she was home at that point, you know, and she was like rolling around in her bedroom, holding a pillow to her ears, crying. And me and our other roommate, Ann McLean, were like, do you want to go to a movie? Like, should we go out? You know, because it was in the afternoon. I mean, there wasn't, you know, we didn't have a lot of money and there was no like club to go to at that point, you know. She's like, I just wanted to stop. And Ann was like, and just said, I'll tell you what, why don't you just slap some cold cream all over your face and put a towel around your head and go upstairs and tell that bitch to shut the fuck up. But so that happened. And then, you know, that made Belinda laugh. But then Disgrace On was also located between two elementary schools that are still there. And one of them was like kindergarten through eighth grade. And it was a Catholic school at the Blessed Sacrament Church, which also, ironically enough, Disgrace Fund was right across an alley from like the dormitories where all the nuns lived. And sometimes we could hear this one nun like praying out loud and then flagellating herself. I'm not laughing at that concept, but we thought it was super kinky. Just like, we were just like, wow, this shit's real. But so anyway, the other school was like a little kid, like I think it went up to fifth or sixth grade. So a day or two after that incident of, you know, when Our Lips Are Sealed started playing 24/7, we'd wake up to like giggling and screaming, and there'd be like a million kids with their faces pressed up against the windows at recess and like congregating on our porch and sticking their arms through the mail slot. I mean, it was seriously, the only thing I can compare it to is A Hard Day's Night, that, you know, the Beatles film, because it was literally like insanity, like that you just couldn't get these kids like away. And on top of that, and like, you know, the Belinda single, like blaring out, like finally on like day three or four, Ginger, their manager just came and whisked her away to a far safer place. Yeah. So, like the whole like almost the whole trajectory of Belinda Stay and Disgrace On was the Go-Go's, like, you know, going from like obscure LA band to like number one. It was kind of crazy.
So, you know,
hello, did I lose you?
No, we're still here. One of the things that struck me about the documentary was, you know, it seemed like after they got to where they really broke and, you know, were all over the airwaves, it kind of stopped being fun for them. Whereas their stuff when they were working the punk clubs, even if they, you know, they only had the one song, but, you know, then they talked about going over to England and, you know, they had, I don't know if it was, they were on a bill with Madness maybe. And the fans of the ska bands were like yelling at them to take their clothes off and stuff like that. And Belinda was saying, no, yeah, we don't do that. But it seemed like they had a lot more fun before they broke nationally. Would I be off base on that?
Well, I think like right as they were breaking nationally, they were still having fun. But then began like the real grind of, you know, of really what life is like on the road, you know, like in those days. or at that point in your career, you're not in a cushy tour bus. I can guarantee you, you know, it's like cargo vans and sitting on equipment and stuff like that. Maybe they were a little bit above that, you know, later or doing some of it, but you know, even in England, it was like that for them on those tours. It's grueling. I mean, my bands have done lots of tours like that too. And if you're lucky, there's like a driver and a roadie, or your roadie drives, but a lot of times it's the band members taking the driving shift and unloading your own equipment and, you know, setting it up yourself and playing and stuff. So, I mean, before they were on the actual touring grind and then all the press appearances as their records started climbing up the charts, it was definitely more fun. Like, I know during their recording in New York, it was crazy fun. And, you know, I mean, things, when we say things were fun back then, they were fun on a different level than they are now. You know, like in that time period, I mean, it was the 80s. And no matter who you were or what scene you were in, you know, there was always a lot of drugs around. There was a lot of wild parties, all-night parties. There was after-hours clubs. I mean, I'm sure some of that stuff still goes on somewhere, but it wasn't like the ostentatious bottle service dressed to impress. It was everyone cramming into, like, weird illegal basements or, you know, knowing, like, a bar that would stay open after hours or whatever, you know. So, yeah, those days were fun, but then I think that the Go-Go's got to really had to like sort of conform into the business of rock and roll, you know, which is sell records. And their trajectory happened so fast. As anyone could see by watching the movie, it was a crazy adjustment. It wasn't like they had a chance to get used to even almost regular touring, let alone like touring, you know, on top of press appearances, on top of TV appearances, you know what I mean? Like, they were learning it as they went along. And that's a lot of pressure too, you know?
Yeah. So you talked in the documentary, and I definitely want to get your thoughts on the documentary and what you felt about it. But you talked about meeting Jane Wiedlin, and it was on a store, I believe it was on the Sunset Strip, called Granny Takes a Trip. And you guys, yeah. I think, were like you were selling T-shirts. You had created T-shirts. And did Jane Wiedlin ever live at Disgraceland, or did she just crash?
No, she was there all the time. She crashed there. And there was another punk chad that I had right before Disgraceland that we called 909. And that one was right around, Joan Jett lived right around the corner. She lived across the street from the Whiskey, and the building that had used to house all the cage, the go-go dancers that would dance in cages at the Whiskey. She lived in that apartment, and 909 was right across from that. And Jane and Margot and Belinda were at 909 a lot too, but then obviously we got evicted from 909. Go figure.
You kids, you crazy kids.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, Jane was just over there a lot. Everybody was there a lot. Like, yeah.
Gotcha. So having seen the documentary, and it was a great appearance, by the way, Pleasant, what are your thoughts on the documentary? Did you like it? Did you love it? Was it, what was your instinct, your take on that?
I loved it because for a long time, a lot of the girls were, sometimes it would be different ones of the girls were reticent about being forthcoming about what was really going on. And some of it was, you know, earlier on, all that stuff was like sort of hidden to protect their image, you know, because I've seen like lately on social media, a lot of people going, oh, I had no idea the Go-Go's were so punky. And I mean, that wasn't really the idea, but that was kind of the idea, you know, like, I mean, they weren't behaving like America's sweethearts, quote, quote, offstage, but they were beautiful young girls, you know, and their pop songs and the way they dressed and looked, which was not by stylists, by the way, that was all them. You know, it made them look like they weren't like punk rock girls at heart, but they really were. So, a lot of the stuff that was happening then got explored in the movie, and that was amazing. I was like really, really proud of them, and I know that might sound kind of condescending, but I mean, and you know, from my viewpoint, it's like I was proud of them as someone that's known all of them for like almost 50 years. I was proud that they wanted to stay, you know, to just own who they were, you know, and to many degrees still are, you know, at least in spirit and stuff. And it was really like a really, I don't want to sound like an idiot film critic, but it was really like a pretty unflinching look at what was going on. And even when I was writing the my chapters for Under the Big Black Sun, or for like on my podcast, like we can talk about my podcast in a little while, but I was going over with Belinda, can we talk about this, or do you want to talk about that, or is it okay if I write this? And she'd say, yeah, go ahead and write it. And then I would send her, like, you know, her, the finished paragraph of something that I was mentioning, like us trading boyfriends, or, you know what I mean? or like I was doing coke somewhere or whatever. And then she'd be like, okay, you know, like, yeah, that's fine. And then I would be like, okay, I just want to make sure it's fine. And then at one point she just wrote back, I'm over 60. I don't give a fuck anymore. And I was like, oh, okay. I just didn't want to like horrify you. And then Jane actually once got really mad at me because there's a story in my book, Showgirl Confidential, which I'll just say, anyone listening, you can get this book on Amazon or you can go to pleasantgaiman.com. It's all crazy touring stories from rock and roll and from on the road. But so there's a story about Jane in the olden days in that book. And I can't remember where she was or why I didn't use her real name, but I thought it would be good to just use a pseudonym about her. And she got so pissed off at me when I published it. She's like, why didn't you say it was me? You could have said it was me. So Jane was always like, the most outspoken wild child, I think, kind of like, you know, the IDGAF kind of mentality.
I know for a fact, too, Pleasant, that my co-host, Jeff Badrin, had a huge crush and probably still does on Jane Wiedlin. Am I right, Jeff?
Of course, naturally. She, by the way, she looks terrific. Like when they were doing the interviews with them today. So let me ask you a question about the interviews that were done. A couple questions real quick. How big a secret was it that Charlotte had the heroin problem?
It was a pretty big secret. I mean, I think even for a pretty long time, it was a secret in the band, from the rest of the band. But like I said, in those days and that in the 80s, there was another huge sweep of heroin going through LA, and it was easy to get, you know. In LA at the time, I'm just putting this into context or reference for your for all the listeners, all you guys out there in podcast land, everybody in Hollywood pretty much, like, you know, AA and NA hadn't like hit. Everyone was doing drugs, but also everybody that was like, you know, taking acid and doing coke all night and being on speed called heroin bad drugs. So everyone, you know, the other drugs were kind of like social drugs, even if you were doing it every fucking day. But heroin was kind of like the no-no, you know what I mean? Because so many people that were famous had already died from it, or, you know, wrecked their careers from it, or got addicted to it and just wound up on this, you know? So heroin was a secret for anybody then, even if it was sort of an open secret, you know?
And she was kind of regarded as the straight girl of the group. I mean, in the sense that she was the one that all the girls in the group, she was the one that you'd probably least suspect of being involved in heroin.
Well, yeah. I mean, because she looked like it. I mean, she always dressed a little bit, maybe more modestly, I'm saying that in huge air quotes, you know, she had big blue eyes and blonde hair and bangs. I mean, she could have been like, you know, a movie star in the 60s or, you know, in like beach movies, or, you know, she did not look like a heroin addict. That was when everyone thought heroin addicts looked like Johnny Saunders. that was what almost every boy that was a heroin addict looked like.
So, you know, this is you are the type of guest, Pleasant, that at times our executive producer, the great Brian Last, would say, you guys can't go above 2 hours. And, you know, this is the kind of, Jeff, would you agree? We wish we can go like 4 hours.
Because of course. No, these are great stories. I still got questions.
Me too. I still got 6 hours worth of questions that we'll have to get Pleasant back. But as we start to wrap up, we just have a few more minutes. I wanted to ask you too. So of all the bands that came out of Los Angeles during that era and really focusing on the punk rock era and not really the quote unquote new wave era, anything like that, who in your mind should have made it bigger? I know who I think, and I'll tell you.
X should be huge. I mean, X is like, they should be huge, huge, huge stars. Like,
yeah,
they weren't robbed, quote, quote, you know what I mean? Because like, X embodied that scene, you know, and their new album, I got to say, like the Go-Go's new single sounds as fresh as anything that they ever have done. X were like, X, almost anybody in the original scene would say X, you know, I can't say enough good things about them.
I'd have to agree too. And when I heard Alphabet Land for the first time, this was like something from 35 years ago. Like it was that good. And they were supposed to go as the world was, they were supposed to go on tour this year. And I was going to be seeing them with the Violent Femmes at an outdoor venue in the Philadelphia region. Obviously everything's been canceled this year, but I was really bummed because I was so looking forward to it. But Pleasant, tell us, so you mentioned that we can go to your website. I've actually spent time on your website. And I mentioned this too when I was introducing you. You are an author. You've written several books. You've edited several books. We've talked about the two John Doe books, which you have chapters in, Under the Big Black Sun and More Fun in the New World. Between you and I don't want to piss off John, these are my favorite chapters in both books. I know John listens as well, much like Belinda's listening on a weekly basis.
Happy birthday, Belinda.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, John. No, I'm just kidding.
these were great. You are a tarot card reader. You are a world-renowned belly dancer, which I think is incredible. You're a witch. I believe you're a certified ordained witch. I do want to ask you two questions quickly as well. And then I want to talk about where we can get your books and your music also. One is, and Jeff and I have talked about this, and I know I'm setting myself up because I already know the answer. I have a feeling. Do you believe in ghosts?
Oh, hell yeah. I do paranormal.
I knew it.
I do paranormal investigations and house cleansings all the time.
Okay.
I'm a believer. Barry is not.
I'm a skeptic, I have to admit. So when you say cleansing, is this like an exorcism you're doing?
No, exorcisms are with demons. House cleansings are just to get like either bad spirits or like noisy spirits out, or if someone hasn't passed over, get them into the light and out of the person's house if they're bothering it, or just help. It's kind of like being like a divorce mediator. Sometimes you just have to tell the people who have the house or the apartment that's haunted, like, you know, you can get negative energy out of there in a lot of ways, but also sometimes you just help them reach you know, a lot of times what scares people about ghosts, and it takes a lot of impetus and strength for spirits to like throw stuff off shelves or to make the lights blink or do whatever. Like, if you, and this happens a lot in Hollywood. Hollywood is super haunted, even though I've done house cleansings and other places. But sometimes you just need to get the people comfortable with the fact that there's a spirit living there, and just have the person say out loud, I know that I'm in your place, but please don't scare my cats. Or like, you know, the thing you're doing in the closet is like horrifying my 7-year-old. You know what I mean? Like, we know you're here, you know, like just don't scare the baby. So that I do that kind of thing. And I'm going to tell you right now, since you mentioned that my brother passed, I'll tell you a crazy little ghost story to conclude, or spirit story. So right when I got the news of my brother passing, I went out on my back porch and just sat down because I was in absolute shock and I felt like I was going to faint. And I live in a house that's over 100 years old, and there's an apartment building that used to house starlets in the 20s, but now is like a bunch of, you know, out of work actors next door to me. It's a big apartment building, and you can, you know, all through like pandemic, you can smell what everyone's cooking for dinner. You can hear them arguing. You can hear them having fun. You can hear a lot of people having kinky sex, and we always want to yell out, get a ball gag, you're too loud. invest in a ball gag. Quit making this noise right now. No,
those are available at Walmart, Barry.
Yeah. Ratings. I smell ratings, Jeff.
It's the ball gag episode.
Yep. Kinky sex. Yes.
Yeah. But so anyway, this apartment building and the whole air was super still and quiet, and I couldn't figure out if it was because I was in shock. And then suddenly one song blared on full volume, and when it stopped, there was also no noise. So I know that this was like not an accident. It was Seven by Prince. My brother died in Minneapolis where he lived. And the words of the song were just like insane, you know, like right specific to the moment, like no one else can ever compare. I am yours. You are mine. We'll be together till the end of time. So don't cry. And of course, I burst into hysterical tears, but I also did have the wherewithal, like, you know, halfway through the song in disbelief to like tape it. And that part of it was on the tape. And I was just like, this is fucking insane. You know, even though I deal with ghosts and spirits all the time, it was just crazy, you know?
Yeah, and it touched you personally. It's obviously, it was your brother, and it's, you know, yeah, that's incredible. That right there, Jeff, may just sway me a little bit over to the believing in ghosts side.
Stuff, you don't,
your
don't
stuff, believe. No, exactly. Pleasant tells me a story like that.
You get the celebrity on here all of a sudden. Well, now I'm reconsidering.
Yeah, I might be reconsidering.
I get it.
I'm nothing if right. Exactly, Jeff. So, Pleasant, I do have another question, and I'm going to save that. So if I do want to buy your books, if I want to pick up your music, Screaming Sirens, I know I can go to Amazon, but I can also visit your website, correct?
Yeah, if you want to sign the book from me, you can go to pleasantgaiman.com. And if you want to just get one from Amazon, they will send it out to you, and I won't sign it or kiss it with lipstick. Hint, hint, oh, hint. Okay. No. And then I think that there's some of the, my website's pretty outdated, by the way. I need to get it up to speed. It's not majorly outdated, but obviously like since right before the pandemic, just there was not like live appearances and all that kind of stuff, but you can definitely get my books there. You can see discographies and movies, you know, everything that I've been in is on there. There's some fun old punk pictures. You can get the book from there or from Amazon. I believe Apple Music has a lot of Ringling Sisters, which was one of my bands. I think it might have Screaming Sirens. I know there's Screaming Sirens a lot on Spotify playlists and on Pandora. That was my all-girl band from the 80s. I'm trying to think. Oh, yeah. Can I talk about my podcast for a second?
Oh, please.
Of course.
Okay, so I have a podcast that we're just into episode 8. It's coming out this Wednesday. It's every other Wednesday, and it's called The Devil's Music. And it's all punk, rock and roll and occult stuff. And by occult, I mean just talking to crazy rock stars and weird famous people and professional witches about, you know, like their first concerts or, you know, like what kind of music they like, you know, 6 stories we've had together on the road. So like the first episode is Belinda. And I'm here to tell you that's probably the only time you'll ever hear her mentioning saving period blood to do sex magic with.
Wow. Oh, my.
Ratings also.
Yeah. Hashtag get a ball gag. No, I'm just kidding. but But also, like, you know, I mostly interview friends of mine, like people that I've known forever, like Dave Catching from Mojave Lords and Eagles of Death Metal is one of the guests. John Doe is going to be on September 16th. Dana Gould is coming up. You know, it's just, it's pretty much just psychotically fun and sick. Sex, drugs, rock and roll, and sometimes a ghost or a synchronicity kind of story.
Wow.
So you can find that on Apple Music, or that's on like almost every podcast network you can think of.
Wow. Well, we will be posting a link in our Facebook group to not only your website, where, again, if you do order through Pleasant's website one of her books, she will autograph it. And if you're really nice, she may even put lip prints on the book for you. We'll also be posting a link to your podcast, because I know that I have been stuck in the house basically for the last 6 months, like much of the country. I now plan on just running through your catalog of podcasts because I'm super excited. Jeff, I got a little surprise right here.
What?
Jeff, considering that we just talked about Belinda Carlisle's magic period blood, this is not going to be quite as exciting, but yet interesting. Pleasant is not just a professional wrestling fan. Pleasant enjoys Lucha Libre.
Oh,
so
my.
Pleasant, exactly.
Roy Lucier will be happy to hear that.
He will be really happy.
I was the ring girl for Mil Máscaras. And also I was a ring girl dressed as a nurse for a lot of like crazy tag team wrestlers for different ones of evil doctors. Those two things were Lucha Vaboom, which is a wrestling and burlesque show in LA. Yeah. And, you know, I've seen Mexican wrestling, Lucha Libre and Tijuana. And I actually, for no reason, not even knowing this the other day, this is just how my life works. And this wasn't even a COVID thing. I don't even know why. I just pulled out all my old wrestling masks and I found one that I'd gotten near Puerto Vallarta because it matched. It was a Hawaiian print wrestling mask and it matched the shitty ass Target bikini I was wearing on the cruise that I was on. So me and the other girls, this was a belly dancing cruise that was going around Mexico and people could have like margaritas in the classes I was teaching and stuff. So there was like about 50 belly dancers and I didn't have to force, but I kind of encouraged and everyone went for it that we all get like wrestling masks. And at first people were horrified, but then you know how they make a video at the end of a cruise of what your cruise was like? It was always us like dancing at someone that was celebrating their honeymoon's party, like with a million people doing belly dancing and wrestling.
It's a good combo, wrestling and belly dancing.
What?
I said it's a good combination, wrestling and belly dancing.
Oh, yeah. And especially like, you know, when you have a wrestling mask that matches your bikini.
Color coordinated, of course.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I want to tell all your listeners, please follow me on Instagram. I'm Princess of Hollywood.
Princess of Hollywood, which was also the chapter of your book, the chapter that you wrote in of John Doe's book, More Fun in the New World, The Unmaking and Legacy of L.A. Punk. These are two books. If this interests you, this is not Pleasant's books, obviously. You got to get these. You got to read these. I know, though, like, as I mentioned, I am going to be going to your website momentarily.
I just followed you on Instagram.
Look at this. It's immediate. It's happening. So Pleasant, unfortunately, we are hitting our 2-hour time limit and our executive producer is in New York right now going, motherfuckers, you guys are doing this to me again.
He says that about us anyway, though.
He does. And we actually like that.
Sorry, doll.
Yeah.
One more Hollywood air kiss. No.
Pleasant. So this may be, and I don't want you to tell anybody else, but this may be the most fun and my favorite interview in our almost 2 years or 3 years, Jeff, that we've been doing this. It's our 150th episode. Jeff texted me and said, can we invite her back? And of course, my response was, fuck yes, we can invite her back. Pleasant, will you come back and talk to us again? Because I feel like we've got another 3 or 4 hours somewhere.
Fuck yes.
Well, I got to tell you, this has been a massive, massive thrill for me. I know that a lot of our music aficionados that are out there were salivating when we told them we would have you on. I can't tell you, I'm a huge fan. This has been exciting. Jeff, what do you think, man? You're not the punk guy, but you got to admit, this was pretty fucking incredible, huh?
Oh, no, I love hearing about, Belinda's blood and all that kind of stuff. But Barry's got 2 hours worth of unanswered question or questions he hasn't asked yet. I got a good 45 minutes of questions just about the documentary and about all five of the girls. So, yes, we would love to have you come back if you could join us.
Oh, yeah, whenever. Just ask my agent. No, I'm just yeah. Yeah, I would love to come back. This was so much fun.
Oh, well, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
And we definitely appreciate you joining us.
Oh, I loved every second of it. So we'll talk soon.
Great. Thank you, Pleasant.
Okay. Have a great day.
Mwah. You too. Bye. Big kisses.
Bye.
Barry, I hope your Woody has subsided after our interview with Pleasant. She was a lot of fun.
This is one of those Woodies, Jeff, that's going to bring me back to.
And you don't get those very often at your.
No, that's it. I'm like a 16-year-old boy again. I'm on the high right now. This is one of those where I want to pull a Costanza, and Jeff, I'm quitting the show.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about significant shrinkage, but you know.
Well, that's every day for me, but this is it. This is, where does it go from here? Fantastic. What a great guest. I just love talking to her. And it was so exciting. And Jeff, do we have more celebrities coming up?
Well, Breaking Gay Babe with Veteran and Barry will be going Hollywood yet again next week. We have a special announcement. Barry, since you secured the guest, I'm going to let you break kayfabe on who's going to be on the show next week. This is a big one, folks.
It's a big one. So, I thought about it, and you had Pleasant Gaiman on today, and that's my wheelhouse. We had Xander Schloss on 2 months ago. That's completely my wheelhouse. And I'm like, Jeff has put his heart and soul, and you said something to me, Jeff, and I got to admit, you probably said it off the cuff and it stuck with me. And you said this several months ago, and it was when you were fighting cancer, and you said, I get to where I'm doing a podcast that I love and it's in jeopardy. It's in danger. And a lot of that had to do with your cancer treatments because you didn't know how it was going. And with the Xander Schloss episode, you couldn't record because you felt so bad. And I said, I want to do something special for Jeff because he's obviously putting up with a lot of the shit that I like. I want to do something special.
Oh, yeah. People only knew.
Well, if they only knew, isn't that the God's honest truth? But I went to your favorite movie of all time, and it was Blade Runner. And I said, okay, Rutger Hauer's dead. Harrison Ford ain't doing the podcast, no matter how hard I beg or blow. That's not going to happen. Who can I get? So I reached out to a couple people. I reached out to Joanna Cassidy, who's got that very memorable scene with the snake. And there was a hefty fee involved that far exceeded our weekly paycheck, Zach.
Out of the Arcadian Vanguard Network Fund, out of that range?
Oh, it's so far out of the fund that it wasn't going to happen. And then I started looking and going, and then sadly, there are a few people that have passed on that weren't around. And I was able to zero in on somebody that actually has a fucking unbelievable resume in Hollywood. So it's the actor William Sanderson. And I think his greatest J.F. Sebastian, his greatest claim to fame, Jeff, would probably be Larry of Larry, Daryl, and Daryl from the old Newhart show. But
now,
as you pointed out,
I think that his greatest claim to fame besides J.F. Sebastian is E.B. Farnham in Deadwood, one of my favorite TV shows of all time.
And that's what you said to me. Yep. So, Jeff, This is something that I'm thrilled we were able to do. And that is going to be our guest. It's William Sanderson. And Jeff, I'm assuming you're going to have 4 hours of Blade Runner questions for him.
I would say that's a conservative guess. But unfortunately, we're not going to have 4 hours with William, but we are definitely looking forward to William Sanderson joining us for our next episode. I hope you folks will join us. So on behalf of punk rock Barry Rose, that's his new nickname, and our producer, the chef, Sweet Lou Kippelman, I would remind you that Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For our man, Brian Last, who said, and I quote, "I know LA Punk." We'll see you next week, folks.